everyone, and welcome to Longevity Post Podcast. I think it's number 7, Brian. I'm your host, Scott Chaveri. This podcast is brought to you by longevitypost.com and findvitality.org. Joining me, as always, is the brilliant researcher and founder of the Internet's largest natural hair regrowth forum, immortalhair.org, Brian Simonis. Brian, what's going on?
Everything's great. How are you, Scott?
I am fantastic, as always. I'm sitting here in a nice, sunny Phoenix, Arizona day in my backyard, so I hope the background noise isn't too bad for the listeners. But so today's topic is anti-aging, Brian. So a few things I wanted to talk to you about. This is probably going to be a multi-part series on aging and anti-aging. And so I wanted to jump right in. And I was reading an article that you wrote on longevitypost.com called The Power of Indirect Antioxidants. So I think one of the things that most people are at this point in time are generally aware of is free radicals and the antioxidant theory of aging, and how there are antioxidants in certain herbal supplements, there are antioxidants in blueberries, etc. So I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, what is an antioxidant, what is an indirect antioxidant, and why are they important?
Okay, Scott, so when people think of antioxidants, you usually think of the garden variety, vitamin A, or sometimes known as beta-carotene if it's in plant form, or all-trans-retinoic acid if it's in animal form, vitamin A. Or you think of the tocopherols, which is the vitamin E, or the cousins of that, which is the tocotrienols. A lot of press about this, and a lot of people get some of this wrong because they think of, you know, they make sweeping generalities about what vitamin E is, what vitamin A is, and they don't really differentiate between what kind it is. And there's vitamin C, and sometimes the dose is important. So, you know, that is a direct antioxidant.
So Brian, let me interrupt you real quick. So I've read articles on that vitamin A toxicity is a problem. I've read articles that vitamin E is a problem. In general, you disagree with those sentiments, correct?
Right. So there's always something they're not missing. Maybe they'll read a major headline, and, you know, the details are really important. That's what they leave out. And so it really misleads the public, puts them in a state of panic and hysteria, and then they start to question whether they should buy anything anymore. And then, of course, many companies take advantage of just the fact that the public does not understand what these things really are, and they'll get away with selling very cheap, ineffective, or I would say marginally effective substances that might not be that good for you. So you really want a full natural complement of something. If you're looking for vitamin E, you want all 8 isomers.
Right. So some of the studies that have been done on vitamin E were just on the synthetic versions of the tocopherols, and didn't include the tocotrienols, for example. So it's not surprising that those studies might have unfavorable results, for instance.
Right. For example, they use the DL, alpha tocopherol, which is this 1 of 8 isomers. And they also use the synthetic, which is not as effective as the natural form. And, of course, beta-carotene, which is a plant-based form of vitamin A, only 50% of the public can actually use that properly. So there's just always details they leave out. So let's get into what is an indirect antioxidant. Antioxidant.
Brian, before you go there, I just want to have one other quick question. So vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, direct antioxidants. But what is an antioxidant?
Okay. All right, so an antioxidant is, at its basic level, is something that creates or mitigates an unpaired electron. So think of something where you have a free radical, which is basically a substance that can damage your body tissue.
Okay.
You've got water-soluble forms and fat-soluble forms, and what they go in there is they're trying to steal an electron. And by stealing an electron, they're effectively creating damage. So an antioxidant, what that does is that will go after and supply an electron or donate an electron. So that will essentially prevent or mitigate a potential damage that's occurring through a condition called oxidative stress or oxidative damage. And this occurs when you do something involving an infection, something that's inflammation. Maybe, you know, at the basic level, maybe you scratched yourself. There are some benefits to some free radicals because they can stimulate various types of fibroblast activity or mitigate various growth factors or reparative substances. But when you have a chronic inflammation that just does not cease, you're going to have some inevitable damage. So this is where some antioxidants are good for you, and they can really protect your skin, your hair, and maybe other organs as well.
Okay, got it. Thank you. So, so we talked about the direct antioxidants. Okay, so what is an indirect antioxidant then?
So an indirect antioxidant is something that really affects the gene level. You can call it, maybe it's a cellular switch. And imagine, you've probably heard of diseases such as COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or chronic emphysema, or you've heard of maybe breast cancer, or any disease that involves, there might be an environmental contamination, there could be a nutrient problem, where these genes become fixed in maybe an off position, or maybe they are defective, they're mutated. So what an indirect antioxidant can do is it can turn the cellular switch to on, specifically upregulating a powerful glutathione antioxidant. Glutathione is a master antioxidant. Your liver makes it, and when you have a lot of it, it's synonymous with, it's associated with long life, healthy life. When people's glutathione levels are very low, it means that they're not long for this world. They might succumb to some sort of disease. So keeping your glutathione levels high is really what you want to do. And so, but if the genes are switched off in certain tissue sites, you're not going to get the ability to clean out your lungs. You're not going to be able to, the ability to clean out your skin. And so you really want to have that glutathione working and flowing. So an indirect antioxidant modulates a gene, and there is a system of them. They call it NRF2. I think call it NRF, like NRF football. And what these do is they simply turn the switches to on to allow your bodies to essentially clean themselves and keep the glutathione flowing in the tissue so it can bind, capture, and excrete, you know, these unwelcome guests out of your body that might create the free radicals.
Okay, so there's glutathione, and I'm looking at your article. There's also superoxide dismutase. Is that similar? Is that essentially the same thing? Well, it's different, but the same in terms of how it works in the body?
Yeah, so superoxide is another endogenous or body-produced antioxidant system. And there's a very, very pernicious free radical called superoxide, one of the most damaging types of free radicals that the body, can generate. So superoxide dismutase essentially handles that system. And then you have catalase. Catalase is a system that usually diminishes with age. You want catalase because it can help neutralize hydroxy radicals or things associated with excess hydrogen peroxide. You can, imagine if you drink hydrogen peroxide, you're going to feel some effect. I'm talking about a lot of it, not the food grade, but you're going to feel something going wrong very quickly.
Okay, interesting. So what are some examples of the indirect antioxidants that you recommend?
So good examples of this is there's four that people have a general knowledge about. Curcumin is probably the first thing that jumps off my head. Another one is transresveratrol. So people know it as resveratrol. Another one is called sulforaphane. Lots of great press on that as well. And that's the stuff that's found in broccoli sprouts. 50 times more of this stuff in broccoli sprouts than broccoli. And then you have quercetin. Some people call it quercetin. And this is the stuff that is found generally in things like apples. And so they all have the ability to boost this glutathione using the NRF2/ARE pathway. And it's a marvelous thing to take because it helps modulate your immune system. It does much more than just regulate glutathione in your tissue.
Okay. So, and if I'm not mistaken, resveratrol and quercetin or quercetin work synergistically?
That's a great point, Scott. Yes, they do. As it turns out, when you take curcumin alone, a lot of people know, to do that. It's a great spice or component of the spice to incorporate in your diet. When you add that transresveratrol, you really have this amazing synergistic effect. It's sort of like you're you're augmenting the positive gene regulation. Think of it as you're actually down-regulating inflammatory pathways that could eventually create a disease or an unhealthy situation. And then when you're taking things like quercetin or sulforaphane and you're adding that into the whole matrix, the curcumin, the transresveratrol, and so forth, you're even maximizing the level of anti-inflammation protection even further. And so it's almost like you have a greater effect than simply the mere sum of the parts. You're having a magnified effect.
Okay, so in your article, you say, specifically at the end of the article, you say, with chronic conditions such as osteoarthritis, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, liver disease, etc., it makes little sense not to take these if one is interested in their health. Okay, so you covered a broad brush, a lot of chronic conditions there. What about an average healthy person? Is an average healthy person going to benefit from taking these? Or are there any downsides from taking these, if you're healthy?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So what it's really going to allow you to do is everyone really is facing, you know, this environmental toxin issue. There's about 100,000 different chemicals introduced literally in the last 100 years. And this is just an unavoidable situation. Unless you're one of these absolute health fanatics that might be willing to live in a bubble, and that's not even really feasible these days, you're going to get some protection and allow your body to excrete these things. So think of it as sort of a disease prevention idea, but maybe even more than that, you're really extending your potential lifespan. This is really an anti-aging idea. So imagine yourself looking better, feeling better, for longer. That's what that really is. Anti-aging is really not about living just longer. It's about feeling good for much longer as well. So this is something that will allow you to have optimal health rather than just getting by.
Okay. Now, so what about, and I've heard other people make recommendations that these types of indirect antioxidants should be, which are different than, say, a vitamin C, take a food-based source, body takes what it needs, probably pees out the rest. But with substances that upregulate your body's own functions, I've heard people recommend that you should cycle them on and off. So what are your thoughts there? Is there any benefit to cycling? Do you personally take these things daily?
Yeah, I actually do personally take these things daily. And there's a few schools of thought on this idea of cycling. It's been brought to people's attentions many times. There's usually something that needs to be explained about that. Usually when people think of natural substances, there are times where cycling is a good idea. For example, there are certain herbs or substances that might cause a temporary or a transient effect, something that you're not likely to experience if you continue to take these things every day. That's one issue, and there are certain substances that do have an interesting effect. I would call that more of a drug-like effect, where it's something that's not normal for your human physiology. But these indirect antioxidants serve a very different function. In fact, they've been used in the diet for thousands of years, and they have a long history of use. So it's not really something you need to cycle. In fact, all it really does is confer protection. So it doesn't run into any issues. There is a downside, though, if you decide to have a more is better attitude. There is a limit or a diminishing return to what you're going to get if you decide to intentionally just take a lot more than you really should. So what can happen there is you might actually, some of the antioxidant or even anti-inflammation effect might be the fact that some of these things bind or chelate certain minerals in excess. So let's say if you took too much resveratrol, you might find you might have a flare-up of arthritis because you don't have enough copper that's actually producing something called superoxide dismutase, which is something that complexes with copper.
So that's interesting that you say that, because I have had that exact experience. When I first maybe 6-7 years ago, I found an anti-aging website. I think it's longevity.org. You're familiar with it. And yes. Back at that time, you know, resveratrol was relatively newish, and people were experimenting with it. And then some people on the forum were taking very, very high doses, like 600 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams a day. And so I experimented with it, and I think I took 300-400 milligrams a day, and within a month I had horrible joint pain. And then I realized anything over 300 milligrams a day was a problem for me. So now I'm down to, I think I take 200 milligrams a day, usually. I do personally cycle once in a while, but it's just sometimes I run out, don't, it's kind of a natural cycling, not necessarily a I'm planning to do so, but if you run out of it, and then you have to reorder, and a couple of days go by or a week goes by. But yeah, I mean, I have that. I've definitely learned the hard way to investigate, and my general rule of thumb is try to take the minimum effective dose, because more is not always better.
Exactly, and there are benefits to all of these four mentioned indirect antioxidants at fairly modest levels, so it's not necessary to take a lot. I remember when the research came out on resveratrol suggesting that maybe there was life-extending benefits at very, very high doses. This was tested in very small animals, and of course that's probably why Longevity and other things were promoting the idea of super high-dose resveratrol at the time. So,
Complaining. Your recommendation on resveratrol is what, 1 to 200 milligrams a day?
Yes. And that's really ideal for the human systems, between 1 and 200 milligrams per day.
And then how about curcumin?
And curcumin has a bit of a range. In fact, this is an interesting question. A lot of people, in fact, a lot of journals and various people in the medical field have this idea that because curcumin does not have a very has a very low absorption into the bloodstream. And so they have this idea that because the bloodstream absorption is very modest, if barely detectable, that there's no function. But the reality is it affects the microbiota, you know, which is the overall beneficial flora in the body. It also affects the liver enzymes. And so, in fact, both resveratrol, which is also known for generally low bioavailability in the bloodstream, plus curcumin, they activate liver enzymes and affect the intestinal microflora in such a positive way. And that's really where some of the workings are happening there. And that's really the most important system in the body in terms of your overall immune system, and as well as just protecting you from different environmental insults.
So how much curcumin do you
So curcumin, you could really have quite a range of it. I think anything as little as 50 milligrams to 500 or 1,000 milligrams. So you don't really need the mega dose. You don't have to take several gram doses.
And then I know sulforaphane, you need very little, right? Mm-hmm. Like just what, 5 milligrams or something? It's very small. Do you know offhand? 5 to 25?
Yeah, so there are people with certain respiratory conditions where 5 milligrams is not going to be enough to really do any magic for them. So if they graduate to something more like 30 milligrams, they're going to probably get an effect where they have maybe an anti-asthmatic effect, or it's actually great for something like COPD or emphysema or anything where you've got a debilitating respiratory condition, something around an area of maybe 30, 40, 50 milligrams of that a day.
Okay, so shifting gears. So you've done a really good job of explaining direct and indirect antioxidants, your specific recommendations on – we didn't talk about direct antioxidants. Do you take any yourself, or do you mostly focus on the indirects?
I really take them all, so everything really has its place. I don't really focus on the plant-based vitamin A's, and there some of that comes in the diet. Only half the population can really make use of the beta carotenes or the trans carotenes, you know, the plant-based stuff. I take a little bit of the animal type of vitamin A. It's a great combination with if you're taking any oral vitamin D, it's a good idea to have that. I do take something called type of all the vitamin E's, you know, and you have your alpha, beta, delta, gamma tocopherol, and also your alpha, beta, delta, gamma tocotrienol. Yep. So take, you know, that. It's a really nice thing to take. And I also take, as far as your indirect okay. antioxidants.
No vitamin C? No vitamin C?
Yes, I do take vitamin C. I do. And, you know, a point of fact, I like to take vitamin C away from my food because it can increase iron levels, iron absorption. For women, that's a good idea because they menstruate and they lose a lot of iron. But for men, you really want to stay away from iron because we over-accumulate iron, most men, unless you have a bleeding ulcer, and you can actually age. So you really want to avoid the vitamin C unless you've got low iron count. So I take the vitamin C away from my meals on purpose. So I take that, and indirect antioxidants, I take pretty much all the four we were talking about, the curcumin, the trans-resveratrol, the quercetin, and the sulforaphane. In fact, I take it in one single pill called Antioxidant Boost. Just makes it easy. And I just sort of set it and forget it. Take it with my meal. Good to go.
Anything else?
What else do I take? Yes, actually, there's another NRF2 supplement I forgot. It's called Echolonia Kava. That's also a NRF2, but it does a whole bunch of other things as well. Yep. A lot of people have this idea that antioxidants do just one thing. They really don't. They do a plethora of different conditions that really enhance your body's ability to do what it's supposed to be doing. But when you've got various challenges, you know, whether it's the diet you're eating or just the environment you're exposed to, the body's just not working in its highest capacity. So some of these things really allow your body to reach the highest level, even improve your exercise performance. And let me just segue to one other important thing, unless this is not mentioned, is when someone takes a direct antioxidant, such as vitamin C, vitamin E, or vitamin A, you don't really want to take this during exercise. Right. Because when you exercise, you're producing free radicals, which is actually a good thing. When you produce some free radicals during oxygen or an aerobic exercise, you are actually modulating your system to have certain benefits. But if you can take an indirect antioxidant, completely safe, all indirect antioxidants are very safe with exercise. In fact, they can improve exercise performance.
Okay, so that is kind of a segue into my next question. So in terms of is all oxidation bad, right? I've heard of high-dose vitamin C being pro-oxidant. I've heard of such things as ozone therapy is basically oxygen therapy. So what about this theory that you can, like we've said, you can have too much of a good thing and you do need some oxidation in the body, and the example you gave was exercise, but what's your general thoughts on, you know, is some oxidation good, and can we take too many antioxidants?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question, and people have been proposing this idea that maybe antioxidants are detrimental, maybe they're dangerous, maybe they're not anti-aging. Well, so there's definitely two sides to this story. You really want oxidation. It's a welcome, it's a very healthy thing. And so there are problems, you know, on both sides of this issue. So I personally make sure that I do have things that encourage a pro-oxidation effect. So I'll give some examples. Like you mentioned, when you take anything above 500 milligrams of vitamin C, it goes from an antioxidant to a pro-oxidant. And this is actually quite beneficial.
But can you explain why? Because we just, in about 20 yes. minutes ago, we said that free radicals and stealing electrons was bad. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right? And antioxidants neutralize those. And now we're saying that pro-oxidation is good.
Right. And one thing I did preface, though, with that earlier mention is that free radicals do have their place. What does go wrong is where you have a chronic low-grade inflammation. That's where you just have a constant battle of free radicals rather than just a little bit. Now, what's the benefit of a free radical or an oxidative therapy or a pro-oxidative substance is what it does is it gets your body to generate change. You know, it might increase certain things like fibroblasts or anything that might repair tissue. So free radicals initially are a way of getting the body to go into gear and to start, you know, reparating, basically just rebuilding, recreating, remodeling. It's just that when this gets out of control, you have a problem. So ultimately, you really want healthy oxidation, something that's just temporary. You know, exercise is a great example of that. You're You're lifting weights, maybe you're running, you're doing something. It's a short-term activity, and everyone knows that too much exercise can be bad. I hope that most people know, because when you have too much, you can start producing catabolic substances. You know, think of cortisol or anything that breaks down muscle tissue.
Right.
So that's an example of too much. So there's something called healthy redox balance. What that simply means is it's a healthy balance between oxidation and antioxidant. So if you take something like sulfur, for example, sulfur is a substance that's very necessary for all cells and improves the ability for distribution of oxygen in your body. And you really want that. In fact, what's interesting about oxidative therapy is that when you induce oxidative therapy, your body upregulates glutathione. So really, an oxidation therapy actually increases antioxidant activity at the same time. And this is what most people don't understand, is that one leads to the other. It's not strictly pure oxidation. When you do an ozone therapy, which is O3, you know, rather than O2, which is oxygen, that extra bit of oxygen can go out, and pretty much, if you see a pathogen, you know, something that's an unhealthy tissue, it literally goes out there and just wipes it out. And a pro-oxidative therapy is such because if it sees that there is no electron-coated ring around this pathogen, the pathogen is devoid of electron protection. It'll just go after there and pretty much just extinguish it. But a healthy cell has an electron coating, therefore it's protected against a pro-oxidative reaction. So they're both good, just in the proper context.
Okay, so a bit of a tangent, but so you mentioned that, and I've heard this before on the exercise front, that taking vitamin C, E, right around exercise is a bad idea, because you actually want that hormetic stress from exercise. You want that kind of micro-inflammation to happen so that you stimulate the repair process, and that's actually how exercise works. You kind of tear it down, and then it builds back up, hopefully stronger than it was before, right?
Absolutely.
So I've heard that before. So then when you say that sulfur, and I know that you recommend MSM and sulfur as a supplement as well, is a pro-oxidant, does that mean I should not take sulfur at the same time I take vitamin E? I'm extending the logic here, right? Like, sulfur is a pro-oxidant, vitamin E is a direct antioxidant, so should I take those at separate times, or does it not matter?
It actually does very much matter. Sulfur is a real interesting nutrient because it's very sensitive to anything else, and so you really want a half-hour window when you're taking sulfur. And there's much more to that than just the whole antioxidant thing. It's simply very, very sensitive just about anything. So if I take it, I try to find a type that's so pure that it doesn't have any adulterants and contaminants. You take it strictly with water. I don't even take it in a capsule or a tablet form, because the excipients or the tablet or even the gel cap or the veggie cap, however it might be, will also disrupt its full potential. So
interesting. Okay,
that's something I'm really careful about. So yeah, no.
So sulfur. Okay, so it was an interesting example. So sulfur is over and above the antioxidant angle. Sulfur is something you want to take away from other things and take it in a purest form. Just as a quick tangent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, fascinating. Well, we're coming up on the end of the podcast. It's been a lot of good information. So I think this is going to be part one of a multi-part series. I think with anti-aging, there is so much that we can talk about. I mean, we filled up a half an hour just talking about antioxidants, and there's so much more to it. So I'm excited to kind of start the new series, and I appreciate your time. Folks, if you like the podcast, please subscribe on iTunes. Please leave us some comments and some feedback. We're also going to start a Q&A section, so if you have any questions or comments, please, you can go to the forum on immortalhair.org. You can find Brian on there. His handle is Caustic Symmetry. You can send him a question directly, or you can post it on the forum, and we'll address it in future podcasts. So, Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
And we'll see you next time.